Good afternoon. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome back, everyone. It's good to see you all after a little break. We've got a fairly full agenda for today, so I think we'll go ahead and get going. And we'll start off first with approval of the minutes. Any volunteers?
Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. So Representative Christensen moves the minutes from March 26th. Any questions or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are adopted. Thank you. And let's see, Representative Carlson, we have you first up on the list, so you can get on with the rest of your afternoon.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
And I will go ahead.
It should be an amendment that if someone could move it on.
Yes, so I will go ahead and get your bill in front of us. So I move House File 2113 be sent to Ways and Means with my intention of laying it over today, the possible inclusion. And there is an author amendment, and members, you should have that in your packet. It is the A15-0385, if I'm correct. And so I would go ahead and move the amendment as well. And if you want to go and explain that to us or explain the bill, whichever order you want to do this in.
Well, Madam Chair, the amendment was to delete everything, so that becomes the bill.
Okay.
So however you choose to proceed.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and adopt it to get the bill in the shape you'd like, and then you can just walk us through it. So any questions on the A15 amendment? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the A15 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Right, and amendment is adopted. Representative Carlson.
And Madam Chair, it's always nice to be back when I'm before this committee and other education committees. When you call for a vote, I'm often tempted to vote because I chaired one education committee or another for about 20 years and served on various education committees probably about 30 years. So there's that tendency to almost automatically say aye or nay. But thank you for the opportunity to appear today on behalf of the bill. I'm going to make my comments very brief. I have Mr. Berger with Lionsgate Academy with me that can explain in more detail the need for the bill. But the bill essentially resolves a cash flow problem that Lionsgate and two other charter schools that serve special needs students are encountering relative to their cash flow. They also have a handful of students that are not special ed students. I think in the case of Lionsgate, I was told there were three. The other school, Fraser, has six students. And I said, well, if they're not special needs, what's the reason that they're enrolled there? And told that it's frequently a family issue. They have siblings that are enrolled in the school, and therefore the family would like to have the other students enrolled as well. So mainly this is a shift in payments, so the main thrust of the bill would be no cost other than the cost of about $30,000 for those students who are enrolled that are not special ed. But if it's all right, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Berger that can explain the need in more detail.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Berger. If you please just introduce yourself for the record.
All right. I'm Ron Berger. I'm the finance director at Lionsgate Academy.
Thank you.
And thank you for the opportunity to testify. In addition to what Representative Carlson has said, first of all, I want to stress that this bill would be limited to students who have 90% or more of their student population covered by IEPs. This bill, more than 95% of the funding requested in this bill is an accounting shift, not new money. And the value and the accounting shift saves our school alone enough interest expense to pay for the new money that's requested in this bill. The acceleration of payment allows us to match the funding that we get from the state with the educational requirements that are mandated by the students' IEPs. So it corrects a timing deficiency. And it reduces the holdback to our schools to what folks usually think of as the holdback in the state of Minnesota. So with the adoption of this bill, our holdback would be about an average of 12%. And February 28th, our holdback was more than 25% because of the timing of some of the various forms of state special education aid at that time. The bill as proposed does not need not change MDE's existing processes around reconciliation, and it also does not increase or decrease the costs that are currently tuition billed to other districts, the resident districts that our students enroll from. If there are, that's the extent of my testimony, and Madam Chair and members, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
And we also, Madam Chair, we also have others available. I think they're on your list as potential testifiers, but they're here to answer questions if need be.
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you have any other people who wish to offer testimony on the bill, Representative Carlson or Mr. Berger?
Just to answer questions, if there were some, they're behind me. I understand the department wants to make a comment or two at some point.
Okay. Very well. Any questions from members at this point? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify? And I see Mr. Uni here. If you would like to come forward, I understand the department would like to offer a few comments.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Adosh Uni, Government Relations Director with the Department of Education. Our staff down in school finance are looking at this bill and looking at the complexities of it. I understand the concerns of the advocates who have brought it forward. At this time, we'd like to, you know, we're still looking at it. We'd like to work with the advocates and the author to get it in the form that's best. I know that the department works very hard to make sure that the respective schools are getting their funds on time. Obviously, sometimes things don't work out perfectly, but we'd like to work with everyone to see what we can get done.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Appreciate your comments. Any other questions? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2113 as amended? All right. Not seeing anyone else. Representative Carlson, any final comments?
Well, Madam Chair, just a thank you to you and the committee members, and we'd appreciate further consideration then as you put the omnibus bill together.
Thank you.
And we'll be happy to work with the department if they have any questions.
Very good. Thank you. We appreciate it, and thank you, Mr. Berger, for your testimony. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 2113 as amended be sent to Ways and Means, but with my intention of laying it over today for possible inclusion. So, thank you. All right. Representative Dabney, are you ready to go? All right.
Afternoon, Madam Chair. Which bill would you like to take first?
You know, your choice. Do you want to go in numerical order and do 17 first?
I like the simplicity of that. I do have a couple of testifiers on House File 1217. Madam Chair, thank you very much. And if I could move House File 1217 to be before the committee for possible inclusion, I trust that's the motion.
Close enough. That's good. Yep.
All right. Thank you. Madam Chair, there are a number of elements of House File 1217 that Chair Erickson included in the omnibus policy bill. But there is one piece that's missing, and that's the financial aspect, which is, of course, in this committee's jurisdiction. And I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill today. House File 1217 provides us with an opportunity to strengthen rigorous course offerings for Minnesota students across the state, to support schools in offering and hopefully expanding those opportunities. And those opportunities are matched with strengthened accreditation requirements to ensure that these opportunities for students are quality and college level, because, of course, they get the opportunity to access college credits for these. With me today, I think we'll start with the Center for School Change first. To be able to speak briefly to how this bill is a little different than some of the other concurrent enrollment bills that you've already heard.
All right. Welcome. If you please just state your name for the record, and then we welcome your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Marissa Gustafson. I serve as Assistant Director at the Center for School Change. As some of you may know, part of our work has been dedicated to increasing awareness and opportunity for more students to participate in dual credit to help increase their high school graduation rates, reduce the achievement gap, and save money for families. We do this because of the immense body of research showing the dramatic positive impact these opportunities can have on high school students, especially those from the most underserved populations. They graduate high school and enter and graduate from post-secondary at higher rates when they have these opportunities, saving them both money and time. And I would be happy to share that research with any of you if you'd like. Today I'd like to speak briefly about this bill and what it could do for students and families across Minnesota. We are very happy that concurrent enrollment, where high school students take college courses right on the high school campus, we're very happy that that has been receiving a lot of attention this session, but I would urge you to consider this bill, House File 1217, as the most comprehensive and effective proposal in this area. This bill makes three important policy changes and provides crucial financial support for these programs. For policy, it includes career and technical education courses in the already mandated yearly report the Department of Education produces. And we know that CTE is important and we need to track it more comprehensively. Secondly, it expands concurrent enrollment course eligibility to 9th and 10th graders, something that has been available in AP programs, for example, for many years. Under this proposal, 9th and 10th graders would be able to participate in these courses when approved by both the high school and the college, not just when their enrollment is necessary to make the course viable, and not just for world language courses. If a student excels in math, for example, in 10th grade, why wouldn't we allow them to access the course that meets their academic needs? Lastly, a policy change is made to extend these opportunities to students who are not on track to graduate and who may need an extra year of high school. Allowing these students to participate in a college course gives relevance, meaning, and hopefully the motivation to complete high school and then move on to post-secondary. It doesn't make sense to make this valuable bridge to post-secondary off limits to students who maybe have gotten off track in high school. In terms of financial support, this program has been, in my opinion, severely underfunded for a number of years. The current $2 million cap on the reimbursements to schools can severely limit the ability for small and especially rural high schools from creating and growing these courses, especially as the demand has increased. Schools have seen the impact these courses can have on their student success and the overall school culture and the school's success. Meanwhile, there has been several more million dollars available for AP and IB programs. This proposal seeks to fund the demand and reimburse schools at the intended amount, not at the limited current prorated amount that is less than 25% of what the legislature had initially intended. Due to demand, some programs, such as the U of M CIS program, which Ms. Williams will speak about, have had to close the door to additional schools. They simply cannot meet the demand and don't have the resources to expand this programming. Providing the support and incentive for post-secondary institutions to work with more high schools will allow expansion and more access to more students in Minnesota. Additionally, there is specific funding available for colleges to create new CTE, career and technical education concurrent enrollment courses, offering more exposure to high school students to careers in those fields, which we know is important. There is a small amount of money to help raise awareness of these programs, which is especially needed in underserved communities where families have often never heard of these courses and what it can do for their students and their families. There is also money available to high schools to help start up these courses with some of those initial costs, helping to defray the initial costs of teacher training, course development, and creating those partnerships with colleges. With these policy changes and targeted investments, Minnesota would be making smart, sustainable, and proven programs more widely available for all of our students to get them started on a successful post-secondary journey, into a career, and to be the cornerstone of Minnesota's future. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Gustafson.
Also with me today is Ms. Williams from the University of Minnesota's Concurrent Enrollment Program, College and the Schools.
Welcome.
And I know that the pages have come along with come around, I believe, with packets for members that detail the U of M's work across the state, and Ms. Williams can speak to them with more depth.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill. My name is Julie Williams. I'm the director of college and the schools at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Our program is the largest in the state. And if you take a look at the first handout, which is labeled Value of Credits Earned Through the U of M Twin Cities College and the Schools 2013-14, you'll see the impact that our program has had on school districts that you may recognize as being from your district, but also on the state as a whole. And if you turn to the last page, you'll see the number of student registrations in college and the schools in 2013-14 was more than 13,000. Students earned more than 52,000 University of Minnesota credits through CIS. And the fees that we charge are $145 per course registration. We charge that to the schools. $145 per registration, not per credit. And that total came to $1.9 million, which is what the high schools invested in offering concurrent enrollment to their students through the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. The value of those, if those students had attended the University of Minnesota anywhere, would have been more than $24 million. So it's quite a good return on investment. I also just wanted to point out that not all of the students, of course, are going to matriculate to the U of M, but if you take a look at the second handout, which is labeled credit recognition, you'll see that even if they don't, the credits that they earn through the University of Minnesota's program are widely recognized coast to coast. So they are going to save tuition if they choose to, no matter where they go. And then the last thing that I wanted to point out was that a very important reason that we are supporting this bill is that it requires NACEP accreditation. It requires accreditation through the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships, which is our national accrediting body. And the College and the Schools program at the U of M Twin Cities has been accredited since 2005. And it makes a huge difference in how concurrent enrollment programs approach their policies and procedures. So if you want to take a look at the last handout, which is ensuring university quality, these are the types of procedures that we have in place to make sure that the course that's offered in the high school is the same as the course that's offered on the University of Minnesota campus. And that includes things like the faculty at the university select and prepare the high school teachers. They also make classroom visits to observe the teachers teaching. We do evaluations of the teachers. We submit the same student evaluations that are used on the University of Minnesota campus. And probably most importantly, the teachers are required to attend professional development on the U of M campus, led by university faculty in that discipline, 3 times a year, at least 3 days a year. Some of the cohorts use or ask their teachers to attend much more than that. So, for example, one of our cohorts has a required teacher professional development workshop of 4 days every summer. And some of them, it's 1 day every summer. And then all of them, it's a day each term during the school year. And I'm available to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. Williams.
Madam Chair, I know Mr. Amoroso wanted to give a thumbs up, at least from the audience. You may want to expand on that slightly.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director, Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I just wanted to say that we've been working on this bill with Representative Dabney and the Center for School Change, as well as MREA, from the beginning of the session, and feel good about the content of the bill. In the past, we've had some concerns about opening up these opportunities to ninth graders and even some 10th graders. But we're pleased that the bill in front of you does provide that opportunity, but also provides that opportunity at the discretion of the school district and the post-secondary institution, which we believe is appropriate for that age child. With that, I would also stand for questions, and thank you.
Thank you. We do have a question. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that the college and the schools is a better approach to providing additional college credit, because there's also the infrastructure from the school district for those students so they can address other needs, transportation's there, et cetera. But my question is about who pays for the teachers getting that accreditation, or is that taken out of the $145 course fee, and also the continuing education with that teacher as well?
Sure.
Ms. Williams?
Thank you. So the $145 that the school district pays to the college and the schools program covers all of the teacher professional development, the required professional development. We do not cover the cost of subs or transportation for those teachers to the Twin Cities, but we cover the cost of paying the faculty to oversee the course and provide and organize the professional development. So the $145 goes towards paying faculty, paying for parking, paying for food, paying for rent for rooms when we need the, when the cohorts are large enough that we need to do that. Did that answer your question?
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, just so, but there's no initial cost for that teacher to get accredited to teach that course?
No, there's no initial cost for that. That's included. And the teachers, by the way, are not the ones that are being accredited. It's the program. It's the college and the schools program that's accredited. And what that means is that we have policies and practices in place to ensure that the course that's offered in the high school is the same as the course that's offered on campus.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gavney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Peterson, I agree with you that this is a better way of offering rigorous course studies. And I'd just like to briefly comment. What the research shows, one way that this is a better way, is that students of color who take dual enrollment courses not only do better in those courses, but are more likely to graduate from high school and more likely to persevere in post-secondary institution to graduation. And so if we're looking at issues around the achievement gap, dual enrollment or concurrent enrollment is a piece of that puzzle for us to solve in a better way.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how does the college and school program deal with the prerequisites that are has to be taken at the high school level first before taking these college courses?
Ms. Williams.
Thank you. So each course, the department at the university that allows us to offer that course through college and the schools determines the student eligibility criteria. We have just moved from a model where most of those courses required students to be in the top 10 or 20 or 30% of their class to a model where we are describing the skills and understandings that students would need to be able to be successful in that course. So we're trying to move away from class rank because it requires an overall academic ability that may not be required to do well in a single individual course. The prerequisites are also determined by the department, and not all courses have course prerequisites. So, for example, calculus would require students to have had, I think it's a B+ in algebra, something like that. But the English literature course would not have a prerequisite that students have taken a literature course prior to taking the university course. Does that?
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Madam Chair. So based on high school, though, could the school district could make some prerequisites in order to take certain college and school courses on their own? Mm-hmm. Am I assuming that they can do that?
They can. Yes, we don't object to that, right? We don't try to control what the high school does. As long as they're meeting the requirements for offering a University of Minnesota course, we don't try to control how they do the grading for the high school grade. We don't try to control how they manage the flow of students into the U of M courses.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Peterson's question, I, too, think this is a very good program. You mentioned these faculty training sessions. It doesn't cover the cost of hiring substitutes, for example. What we're hearing about the shortages of substitute teachers and additional cost to the school. So how many teachers would have to go to these training sessions or get to go to them? And then could they be held in the summertime when school is not in session? What's the schedule for that? What does it look like?
Ms. Williams.
Thank you. So all of the cohorts require that teachers come once during each term. So, and the university is on a semester schedule, so it's twice during the school year. It's every teacher who teaches for us, and it's every year that they teach. So it's ongoing, and it's required. We do require teachers to come in the summer, but the amount of time that they spend at the university in the summer varies depending on the discipline. So it can be anywhere from 1 to 4 days. During the school year, it's 1 day each term for each teacher. We do, or we have, talked about trying to shift more of that, the term academic year workshops to the summer. And I don't know if that will happen or not, but it's something we're considering right now.
Representative Anderson? Fellow? Okay. Representative Newton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who pays for the books for the classes? Do the students pay for them, or are they paid for by the schools themselves?
Ms. Williams.
Thank you. So schools, again, we don't try to interfere with that. We do not provide the textbooks. We only say these are the textbooks you have to use, or these are your choices for textbooks. So how the schools do that, I imagine, is regulated by the requirement that students have a free and appropriate education. I don't think, can the schools charge families? I don't think they can. So the school itself would be bearing the cost of the textbooks, just as they would if the course were only offered for high school credit.
Further questions? All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1217?
Madam Chair and Representatives, I'm Ann Hobby from Parents United, and I just want to chime in and say we've heard a lot of support from parents for this. They're very excited about the 9th and 10th grade component. The value that it adds them at a time when, you know, college costs are prohibitive is really wonderful, and this one's really comprehensive. We love as an organization that this reaches out to students who otherwise might not take these courses. So the CTE component and the outreach are terrific. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hobby. All right, is there anyone else who wishes to offer testimony? All right, seeing none, any other questions from committee members? Representative Marion.
Chair, Representative Dabney, so I've met in the past with some of the individuals who have spoken here on behalf of the bill. And one of the things that I was not perhaps fully aware of was the geographic scope of this program, of this effort. Obviously, as a St. Paul person, I know my local high school participates pretty heavily, as does a couple of other high schools in St. Paul. But I'm wondering if maybe you or your testifiers can expound a little bit about the prevalence of college and school programs throughout the state. Is this an urban program? Is it a rural program? Is it both? Do we have gaps, et cetera?
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mariani. Let me pull that question apart a little bit for you. If you look at this part of the handout, you see just from the University of Minnesota's College and the Schools program, and that's kind of, I think of that as their Kleenex to facial tissues. College and the School is their trademarked term for concurrent enrollment. You see a statewide impact, everything from Roosevelt and South High Schools in my district to John Marshall in Rochester to New Prague to so on and so forth across the state. Keep in mind that at the same time, parallel to the University of Minnesota's program, a number of the MinSCU institutions have relationships with their local high schools and also offer concurrent enrollment classes. So this really does, these opportunities spread across the state. I think one of the challenges that in both public, traditional public charter and private schools that we're going to see is that we first passed funding in 2000, I'm looking to Mr. Strom, 2007? Yeah, sure. I think that was his yeah, sure face.
In the general nod.
And while we stipulate in statute $150 a student, we actually are paying under $40 a student. So now go back to Representative Newton's question about the cost of textbooks and think about what you paid for textbooks in college, or maybe more appropriately, what young people today might be paying for textbooks in college. And the textbook alone can be greater than not only what we're actually paying high schools, but what we even told them we would pay them. And I think that is increasingly going to be an issue as school districts look to how do we meet the needs of kids, how do we meet the desires of families, how do we get, how do we attack the rising cost of higher education for our students in a way that fits within a K-12 budget. And I think increasing our funding at least up to the current statutory level would open up the program significantly.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Babney, so there's a lot there that you just shared, and I do stand corrected. Statewide, it's not College of the Schools, it's concurrent enrollment program. I think you're presenting a really sound financial argument about, you know, severely unmet needs. So that's one issue. That's a distinct issue, but I suspect that issue is also connected to another issue, which has to do with the real world accessibility of this program for students across the state. And I'm guessing that in socially isolated greater Minnesota communities, you know, this issue of underfunding, if you will, off a formula gets increasingly or becomes more compounded, if you will. And so I just wanted to offer an opportunity for, and I see that Mr. Nathan joined the table, to speak a little bit about that. So the bottom line question is, if we do this, are we going to be able to expand opportunities across the state for students? Obviously, we're going to be addressing the underfunding, you know, under the current access, those who are currently accessing, but are we also going to be able to expand opportunities beyond that as well?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, my wholehearted belief is yes. There are 27 institutions in the state that provide concurrent enrollment opportunities, so 27 higher education institutions. So there's a broad geographic opportunity here. We have schools, as Mr. Amoroso, you know, indicated, who want to be doing this, who are doing this. We also, as I indicated, the research shows that communities of color often do better in these programs than they do in other rigorous course offerings and are also more likely to graduate. So the different ways you can speak to the word opportunity, I think there's a multiple ways that we can respond affirmatively to this these provisions. But I do want Mr. Nathan, if he wants to jump in.
Welcome, Mr. Nathan. If you please just state your full name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to make three quick points, and thank you again for the opportunity to talk with you today. This provides a threefer for members of this committee and for the children and the families and the schools in the state of Minnesota. One often hears about return, and I'm a big fan of high-quality early childhood education, especially, as I read in the papers, as you are, Madam Chair, when it's targeted. But that return on investment, even in the most encouraging statistics, and I speak as a fan of high-quality early childhood targeted early child education, that can take 10 to 15 years. This is an immediate return. I mean, the statistics that Ms. Williams described of about 10 to 12 to 1 are immediate. Families can save literally thousands, in some cases tens of thousands of dollars. So that's point one. Secondly, there's a return on training teachers. There was a question about, does any of this money go to help teachers meet the expectations of the Minsky or the University of Minnesota system? And yes, the answer, committee members, is that there is $1 million in there to do precisely that. And that's one of the distinguishing characteristics of this bill with the collaboration of the MREA and the MASA. So there is some assistance to train teachers. And once they've been trained to get up to the standard that the colleges expect, there's the ongoing effort, but that's a second thing. And the third thing is that when you return to talk with people in your communities, obviously they'll want to know what it is that you've done. And what one of the things that this bill allows you to do throughout the state, as Representative Mariani and Representative Newton and others have said, throughout the state, literally from International Falls in the south, the Austin from north, to Austin in the south, and so on and so forth, throughout the state, these opportunities will be expanded, providing enormous opportunities because, last point, we do have research from the Minnesota Department of Education that youngsters who take concurrent enrollment, which is what we're talking about here, or PSEO, are between 10 and 30 points more likely to graduate from high school through all groups, so that you are having a massive impact on college debt. You're having a massive impact on reducing the achievement gap. You are increasing the quality of the teaching in the schools. And you are providing an enormous return on the investment of public dollars. Thank you.
I'm sorry. And can I have you say your full name for the record so it's on the tape?
My apologies. Joe Nathan, director of the Center for School Change. I've been a public school teacher and administrator and advocate in the state for about 45 years.
Thank you. Additional questions? All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1217? All right. I don't see anyone. Representative Dabney, any closing comments?
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present the bill. I know you've got big decisions ahead of you, but I think we've got big impact here for state dollars and for our students, so I'd appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Dabney. Good bill. And with that, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 1217 be referred to Ways and Means, but with the Chair's intention to lay it over today for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So that House File 1219.
1219, yes. And right. If one of the pages could please, I've got, in addition to what's in your packet, I believe it would be the Minnesota chapter. Yes, it is. The American Association of Pediatrics has also provided a letter in support of House File 1219. Madam Chair, this committee has examined a number of aspects of the achievement gap. Quite frankly, Professor Gunner from the University of Minnesota's Institute for Child Development, in testifying before Chair Erickson's policy committee, I, not surprising to this committee, asked her about the impact of homelessness on children and their academic achievement, and she said bluntly and unequivocally, you will not close the achievement gap until we deal with homelessness. The school districts today collect data under the McKinney-Vento Act, federal law, with a definition of homelessness, on the incidence of homelessness in their classrooms. Over 1,100 classrooms across the state in many districts have homeless students learning in those classrooms. 23% of the school districts in the state have homeless students in their classrooms. They collect that information, that data, on those students. They report that data to the Minnesota Department of Education. And no offense to the department, but it sits in their data collection services there. I think it's valuable to our community and state to unearth that information and report it out as we currently report out information on student academic performance based on race or culture, based on measures of poverty, special education status, and English language learner status. If we want to get to the achievement gap, as Dr. Gunner said, we have to get to homelessness. With me today, I don't know who wants to start out, Mr. Strack from the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I will allow him to introduce himself with his fancy title.
Welcome, Mr. Strack.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Strack, and I serve as the district liaison for homeless and highly mobile students in Minneapolis Public Schools. In this job, I work to ensure students who are homeless have access to and fully participate in school. Last year, nearly 4,000 students enrolled in Minneapolis Public Schools, or almost 1 in 10 of all of our students experienced homelessness at some point. Additionally, almost 2,000 children under the age of 5 were not enrolled in our programming stayed at shelters in Minneapolis. Statewide, more than 14,000 students experienced homelessness during the 2013-14 school year. Homelessness affects many aspects of a child's life: physical and emotional health, stress response, social, nutritional, but perhaps most profoundly, educational outcomes. While some students do overcome the challenges of housing instability, as a group, homeless students score significantly lower than their stably housed peers on standardized tests, and typically they do not catch up over time. Graduation rates and attendance rates are lower. Dropout rates are higher. Our long-standing research partnership with Professor Mastin and her colleagues at the University of Minnesota has shown the need to intervene early, the variability among students, and the overall increased risk associated with homelessness. Schools are often the one stable factor for students facing housing issues. Every day in Minneapolis public schools, hundreds of teachers, social workers, bus drivers, and shelter-based staff arrange transportation, provide extra academic and emotional support, and connect families to community resources. However, despite all of our efforts, families still must move many times from shelters to friends and relatives' houses to churches to hotels and back through the cycle again. Seeing the stark data, along with other factors that influence learning, we can implement upstream interventions and preventative measures, such as affordable and supportive housing. More and more, we recognize that factors outside the school walls influence academic achievement, and homelessness is among the strongest of such factors. In MPS, we analyze data on a number of student factors, including homelessness, so we can provide targeted support and services. And while data often show hard truths, they can also help us see best practices. There are many causes to homelessness, and it also has many consequences. Fully understanding the implication on a child's educational trajectory will allow us to see the full cost of homelessness and move towards solutions to close opportunity and achievement gaps. Thank you.
Thank you. Well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and we're a member organization of a little over 150 homeless service providers around the state. And we're supportive of House File 1219, particularly in light of rising family homelessness in recent years. We know from the 2012 statewide Wilder survey that the largest increase in family homelessness was in two-parent households, and it was up 22% since 2009. Homeless children with their parents make up about a third of the state's homeless population, and about half of homeless children with their parents are of school age, so between age 6 and 17. The data is also useful as we work toward closing achievement gaps. Students of color are disproportionately affected by homelessness. While black and African American children represent 7% of the state's overall population under age 21, they make up 40% of that age group within the homeless population. For American Indians under 21, they're 2% of the state's overall population, but 13% of that age group within the homeless population. Overall, about 36% of Minnesota's homeless population are age 17 or under, while they're only about a quarter of the state's overall population. We're learning more about how housing stability underpins core functions of state government, education being a good example of that. There's a growing body of research on the impacts of housing instability and student achievement. We know that generally homeless students are more likely to lag behind their stably housed peers in academic achievement, particularly in reading and math. And they're also more likely to have trouble relating to peers, be victims of bullying, and change schools because of their housing situation. That said, we need to learn more about whether risks of housing instability are acute or chronic, whether the gaps change and persist over time, and whether there's a presence of academic resilience. Overall, we think that House File 1219 provides a good opportunity to be more intentional about gathering, centralizing, and distributing better data. And we hope this will lead to a better understanding of how factors outside the classroom, in particular housing stability, impact student achievement.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's good to know the information, but I was just curious, do you know what the number one reason for homelessness is?
Wants to take that one, Mr.
Pittsburgh? Sure. Well, there are a variety of factors that we. What's that?
Number one.
I'm. Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I'm going to assume you know the answer. Based on, oh, okay. Well, we know that there are a number of factors. A few that we see most frequently and hear from our service providers, we think of our mental illness, chemical dependency, disability, domestic violence. Those are all things that you might say contribute to a lack of income and ability to afford housing.
Representative Mullery.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of you mentioned Maston. I assume that's Ann Maston at the U, and her specialty is resilience, I know, on brains that haven't formed right. Is there any, has she or, what's his name, Phil Zalasco or something like that? Her, and then there's a woman with a Swedish name there, the three that work on resilience. Have they done studies on the difference between resilience from homelessness and, let's just say, screwed up parents or something, whatever you want to term, dysfunctional parents? Do you know of any studies they've done? Seems like they're the ones that are really into the resilience studies.
Mr. Strack.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative. All three of the researchers that you mentioned are partners with us, and I can't speak to the level of detail maybe you're asking for, although I know it is a field of ongoing study in which Minneapolis Public Schools contributes. And what they're trying to unravel with their research is to figure out how we can promote the factors that would increase resiliency. And you referenced one that I know structured parenting is among those that they're starting to find, but that's still ongoing research that I know they're engaged in. I can't speak to the current status for any of their work.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dabney.
I've been in contact with Dr. Maston. I got to meet her when Representative Mullery brought her in, I think, for one of his bills, or Representative Moran did. But I've got a research paper that she published, and she doesn't go to screwed-up parents, as the question was. But let me just quote this because I think it's powerful and it's brief. The risk associated with being homeless, with homeless status, was not attributable to other well-established risk factors for achievement, including attendance. Importantly, this isn't about attendance. Ethnicity, gender, or qualifying for special services such as special education or ELL. So if you control for all the stuff we usually look at, kids who've experienced homelessness in the past 6 years underperform their peers who've got any of this other package of challenges but were not homeless. That's the power of isolating this, pulling the data out. Every school district in the state has a homeless coordinator. They're collecting the data. The power is pulling that data out and looking at it, because it seems to be one of the most, if not the most powerful, single impact that students carry in with them.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dabney, I was just explaining before you did that unlike poverty, which is not a stress factor, homelessness is, and on everything, and that's one of my arguments with, it's not in this committee, the homelessness task force, because I tried to put in there a partial study on the effect of homelessness and how we needed to work with their brain development, because that was more important to them in the long run than the health and other issues that were the immediate thing. But they all thought, so it sounds like you'll be on my side on trying to get them to relook at that.
All right.
I just had a question. Mr. Strack, in your position with Minneapolis Public Schools, obviously you have a significant number of students in the school system that are fall into this category. What type of services in that do you offer? And are these students that obviously they may kind of go in and out of being homeless or were homeless at one point, and that do they generally self-identify, or you become aware of the situation and offer assistance? Could you share a little bit that with the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. A couple of things. First of all, there's a federal law that governs some of the rights students have, which is remaining in their school they attended before they became homeless, and that then the school district would provide transportation. So we have families who move around many times. We use school buses with older kids, metro passes for the city bus, sometimes taxi cabs when we need to transport those kids back to maintain their school stability. On top of that, schools often through school support staff members, social workers, counselors, that sort of thing, are providing services, helping the family, trying to locate some housing, making sure the kid has school supplies, a uniform if necessary. We can provide some assistance with school fees, AP fees, or something like that. So it's kind of a wide suite of services. Some are rights the students have under federal law. Others are what we see as the right and best way to help intervene on their behalf.
Do you want to talk about staff training?
We have... Madam Chair, members, we have shelter-based staff who help identify students, to your question around identification. We also provide staff training to all of our schools so that they can identify particularly high school-age students who may not self-identify in the way an elementary school student would tell their teacher that they've moved last night or that they're staying at a shelter. So staff training and staff development is really crucial in being able to identify and then provide services.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, as you know, I support the collection of the data that you want in this provision and included it in the omnibus policy bill, but we never really talked or asked the commissioner what then would happen as a result of the collection of the data. Have you had any conversations with her in regard to what would be different once we have the data?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, and again, thank you for including this provision in your policy bill. I just want to pull your language apart a little bit because, of course, we're already collecting the data.
Yes.
This doesn't change anything.
No.
What this changes is the reporting out and making it public. And what the department has explained to me is the small cost associated, which is why we're here today, has to do with back office coding by their computer folks to have the reports that we see, that parents see, include reporting out of homeless students on those school reports. I think it then is up to us to look at those reports and assess what's the impact and what are both the out-of-school actions we need to do. On some level, the answer is simple. House these families. Now, of course, doing that is not a simple task. But for many, that's what they'll need. There may be also targeted educational services or support services within the schools that we'll want to look at. But what I'm hoping to do is, by exposing this with the data we already have, let's then have the conversation in this committee, in your committee, and elsewhere on how do we best meet the needs of these kids and hopefully have a major contribution on the closing of the achievement gap by doing so.
Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Dabney. I think part of the emphasis, too, though, should be on the reasons that you gave, sir, for in answering Representative Peterson's question. So if we have two-parent families, which was noted, but there's mental illness or there is drug abuse or some addiction there, it seems to me that even housing will not solve that, and so we have a larger issue, and I hope we'll have those discussions after this data is reported out. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. I really like it. Having worked in Minneapolis schools, we had a significant number of homeless kids, and my team of teachers got together. We used our own money, and we made backpacks that included shampoo, deodorant, toothbrush, toothpaste in a backpack. So, and we would, when you found out a kid was homeless, and usually it wasn't terribly difficult to find out these were middle school kids, we'd pull them aside and they'd get a backpack. The backpack was unidentifiable, too, because they really don't want anybody to know. The other thing is, representing Richfield and Bloomington, I have a church in Bloomington that is very active with homeless youth. They're very concerned about it. And what they found in Bloomington, and I think this is probably quite true statewide, even in rural areas, is kids that don't feel safe at home for whatever reason, and there's a whole bunch of reasons, They're the couch kids. They stay on somebody's couch until the parents say, what's up with this kid? And then they move to the next couch, and then at the next house, and then they move around. And they're essentially homeless. They're not going home for whatever reason, and they're not at the point of sharing why they're not. And so this Bloomington Church is trying to identify and help temporarily house kids. I just wanted to add that. It's not just, there's been a real focus on Minneapolis, and yes, but it's in every community in this state.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Representative Slocum, thank you, and particularly that last comment, because I was fearing that this would be identified as a Minneapolis issue. Coon Rapids High School, Park Center, St. Louis Park, Faribault, Mayo Senior High, Congdon Elementary, Hinckley Elementary, I could go on. This is not a Minneapolis issue. It may present slightly differently and in larger numbers in the urban core, in part because we have largely isolated the homeless shelters in the urban core. And so Minneapolis public schools may see more of this, but schools and districts and classrooms across the state are seeing this. As I said, the Department of Education has identified over 1,100 classrooms across the state with a homeless child in them or more.
Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is something I've been concerned with for a long time and I've been working on for many years. And frankly, you get a little bit tired of admiring the problem, going back to what Representative Erickson is saying, now what? We're doing some identification. We're not doing adequate identification of the kids who are couch hopping. It's really hard to find out who they are. But if kids are falling so far behind because of an incidence of homelessness, what is the result? What are we going to do? What is the Department of Education going to do? And it's sort of, I appreciate what you're doing, Representative Dabney, but where do we go from here? Not just admiring the fact that we've got this problem and that we're identifying it, but solving the problem and helping the kids. So that's, my 2 cents worth anyhow.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you, Representative Newton. You're right. I would say at least 2 things. One, to date, it's largely been we policymakers who have identified and who've admired the problem. I think we now need to take the lid off and allow the community at large to see the problem, because I would suggest that even many of your constituents may not know about the youth shelter that opened in Anoka Hennepin, may not recognize that kids in their own child's classroom are homeless. And that what we need to do, to get to Representative Erickson's questions and your comments, is we need to open up the conversation. And we do that by elevating the data that we already collect and already report so that the community can see it. And then we can gather around churches, social service agencies, local government, state government, counties, and so on, to then say, okay, now what do we do? Then, secondly, we can also look around the country to models that we may want to explore and adopt. An example, and I'm not suggesting this, but an example I'm aware of is the Tacoma schools have partnered with their public housing authority. Families who've experienced homelessness, who are in targeted elementary schools, receive a voucher. They get to the front of the line for stable housing, provided they keep their child in that school. Now, that may seem a little counterintuitive, but I would suggest that the negative impacts of homelessness are not just on the child who experienced that, but they negatively impact the entire school community, especially when you get to a certain scale. The turnover of kids, the challenges in the classroom, and so on. So by marrying the public housing authority and the resources for family housing stability that they have with the schools, you not only meet the needs of the child and family who have experienced homelessness, but you stabilize that school community and allow everybody an opportunity to greater academic achievement. There's a model for from Tacoma, Washington, that we could look at and explore, but we need to marshal the resources. And I suggest that the first step in marshaling those resources is reporting out the data that we collect.
Thank you. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney. And I'm just going to take that line of thought one more step further, because I think you're right on. And Mr. Uni, you don't have to come up, but I just want to put a call out. As we lift this data up, it's so critical that we find a way to cross-cut this across boundaries. DHS has got to see. I mean, everybody, we've all seen this. The data is so siloed around here, and it just seems so hard to get folks to look inside each other's silos, create some windows so we can say, we can get to those kids in a different way, because I'm so supportive of what you've got here, but we've got to make sure this data actually gets used and lifted up and others can see it, so that we can see the kids across the street and say, let's get to that kid. So thank you for bringing it forward, but just Department of Ed, please reach out to DHS, and I know we are trying, but let's make that a concerted effort and try to solve that.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Chair, I won't belabor it because I think the last two statements by Representative Dabney and Representative Crescia really captured my thought on this, and it really does speak to the power of data and data collection and data analysis and doing it in a different way. You know, several years ago I was at our teen drop-in center in downtown St. Paul, and I was surprised to find out that we had teens from Cottage Grove, from Woodbury, from Washington County, all the way out south and east of us, hanging out in St. Paul, because that's where they hang out, because, you know, it's a big urban center that has some possibilities. When we traveled around the state, Representative Dabney, with the Poverty Commission, mm-hmm. we discovered the same thing, whether it was Grand Rapids or Duluth or Rochester or Winona. Those larger regional centers do become the places where many of our young, unaccompanied, homeless youth are going to congregate. And so all this really does beg this cross-silo thinking that Representative Crescia, I think, speaks about. And I would push this even further, because I know, you know, we're so, you know, for many right reasons, we're so focused on the importance of independent school districts. But frankly, I just don't think any, including my school district, can independently be powerfully, necessarily effective with this community of students. It is going to require a new set, I believe, a new set of relationships and activities that cut across jurisdictions, cut across independent school district boundaries to be able to marshal, you know, some good synergy that's relevant to the lives of these students. And you can't do that unless you're centered on looking at collecting the data and looking at it in a different way. The question doesn't just become, what does this mean for St. Paul schools? The question here then becomes, what does this mean for a region? What does this mean for public housing, you know, entity, our mental health entity, et cetera? That's a different question that's very difficult for many of our present institutions to ask unless there's a compelling methodology behind a collection of data and analyzing the data. So I think you're on the right track here, and I'm really looking forward to us being able to move this and then powerfully be able to work this data the way that we're talking about it here today.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is kind of continuing off of what Representative Newton was saying on where do we go from here? And also with Representative Crescia's comments about partnering across the silos. And in the last biennium, we had the Homeless Youth Act, which appropriated $6 million for the different things that we're talking about here with student outreach in the schools, counseling, shelters, transitional housing. This year I have the honor of being the chief author to increase that funding, an additional $4 million to bring it up to $10 million. And, of course, that's going through the HHS committees. The money goes to DHS and is then administered by DHS across the state to various organizations that provide these services. And so I'm really encouraged to see this bill. So thank you, Representative Dabney, for having this. And I think we need to start breaking down those barriers between the HHS and the education conversations. And so I was wondering if, and it's not clear, and I think Representative Erickson was kind of getting at this, the data that would be collected, is that going to be shared with DHS as well as the Department of Education? I know DHS recently did a report on homelessness, and where are we working together between the two to make sure we're not duplicating efforts but working together, if that makes sense, if you could respond to that.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Wills, thank you. You raise a good point. Obviously, this is data that the Department of Education already has. What I'm not clear on is not only where they overlap with DHS currently on exchange of this data or other data, and what any regulations may be that would either facilitate or hinder the exchange of that data. It's a good question, though.
Representative Wells? Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Dabney. And I think that's the crux of the mm-hmm. issue in making sure that we do have that communication. So I'm sure the departments are listening, and we need to make sure that when we get the reports back on this collected data, it's getting to DHS and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it necessarily has to be legislatively required, but you know, having those conversations. So thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Wills, if I might, we have really kind of two ways of best understanding the homelessness landscape in Minnesota. One is the HUD point in time count. So the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development does a point in time count. The challenge with that is we do it in January. As you might imagine, in Minnesota, it becomes difficult to find people who are homeless in the month of January. The other is the Wilder Foundation here in St. Paul. Every 3 years, does a statewide homeless survey. The most recent one was in October of 2012. There'll be another one this fall. What I can tell you, the challenge with that was that early in the morning, when we were out moving through shelters and actually doing the count, it was pouring rain. So the challenges with collecting data, as good as some of the strategies we have, are many. And I think this would provide us one more opportunity to be able to kind of have a captive, I don't want to say the word captive, I guess, when we're thinking about schools, but one more place in which we can find and count folks and gain a better understanding of their situation.
I know a couple of other members have raised their hands, but I'm hoping to move on because we've got two more bills yet to cover today. So, but we've had really good discussion. So, I'm gonna let it go at that today. Any other final comments, Representative Dabney? I think you've had a lot of good positive comments here from committee members. So,
Madam Chair, you've been very generous today, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate the good conversation we've had bipartisanly in this committee. Thank you very much.
All right. That Representative Dabney renews his motion that House Bill 1219 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, thank you very much to all your testifiers. Representative Quam. And Representative Quam, you want to go ahead and move 1712? And so your motion would be that it be moved to Ways and Means, but my intention is to lay it over today for possible inclusion.
Noted and so moved.
Yeah, very good. All right, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And part of my background was active with the Zumbra Education District, which basically, when you have small school districts, you don't have the, you know, critical mass to cover all of the special ed and some of the other programs. And so several school districts banded together and provided that. so that you could have a psychologist, sociologist, you know, some of the specialties as a joint position with point two here, point three there, etc., and do the scheduling and make it work. And I saw what could be done collaboratively. I also have, over the years, seen situations in my own resident district. You know, a teen, over the years, just the last few years, we've had a couple of teens die in car accidents. One right after school let out. We had a, also I've had teens in my district and neighboring districts that have committed suicide. We had one teen when the snow melted last year. They found his body. These type of situations are tough. Tough on the families, on the students that live and go to school with them, and the faculty. They don't happen with great, fortunately, huge amount of great periodicity, but when you start looking at the towns around, there's quite a bit of occasion. And the thought was, how can we try to adjust these crises? And I thought the easiest, you know, budget-wise and also effective-wise would be to try and have crisis teams. So I went to staff and I said, you know, what can we pull together in a bill to try and start or generate crisis teams so that when something happens in that region, you've got a group of people specialized to help out, because the counselors and the specialists in that district are also impacted by this crisis. And so the idea is to, you know, come up with a solution that leverages the skills and capabilities in the area and is coordinated to be able to, assist in these occurrences. This is the language to start out with. I am open to anyone that wishes to help do something here, but I think we need to start by having the commissioner and the appropriate people have conversations and see what can be done, and work in progress to do what we can. And so I'm open to any comments. I did have some testifiers, but there were some, because this was scheduled over the Easter holiday, it was tough getting a hold of people, and the one that was going to be able to make it couldn't. And then I was hoping for someone that knew about Hastings had to go outside of their school district for support, and I was hoping that we had would have a system where that would be easier for them.
Thank you. Looks like there's somebody who would like to testify on your bill. Please come on down to the table, and if you would just state your name for the record, we'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Johnson. I'm the director of the Minnesota School Safety Center, based out of the Department of Public Safety, Homeland Security, Emergency Management. I would like to speak in support of the work that's being done on this House file. For those of you who are not familiar with the School Safety Center, we support all Minnesota K-12 schools in maintaining safe school environments, working with the educators in the schools, the public safety partners, and being a resource for schools, or for schools, law enforcement, those responders, and the community partners, providing information, guidance, and a significant amount of training and technical assistance in all hazards planning. It's a large umbrella to live under. We coordinate prevention, protection, mitigation, and response, and also recovery activities with federal, tribal, state, and local partners. We have a team of three individuals within the Minnesota School Safety Center that work very closely with the Minnesota Department of Ed, and especially through their School Safety Technical Assistance Center folks. We provide multi hazard emergency planning for schools, threat assessment in schools, bomb threats, violent responses, facility self-assessments, and de-escalation, among many other courses. The reason that I'm here is to speak in support of development of these teams that could be responding should there be an incident that would occur within the schools that is a crisis, such as stated before, school violence, staff death, student death or injury, natural disasters, or the different types of accidents that do impact our schools. What I would like to talk about today is a success story that has occurred right here in the state of Minnesota by a school district in a cooperative area that was able to put together an emergency response team. And this is in the Southwest West Central Service Cooperative based out of Marshall, Minnesota. They were created in 2011 to have a school crisis response team consisting of trained, experienced professionals who provide support, guidance, and resources to the schools and their communities within Region 6 and 8 during a crisis situation. They do that by providing immediate aid and long-term follow-up to crisis events. They connect schools with resources that they may not otherwise know about and provide a consistent response. They do provide immediate assistance to local schools in times of crisis or traumatic events, and the team works with crisis teams and within the crisis plans already developed by the schools. They're mandated to have them, and we help them in that development. Their team members are specially trained by standards set by the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation to respond to school crises. And they've had trainings that have occurred with their team throughout 2011, 2012, 2013, up to the present, and now have approximately 50 persons that are members of their school emergency response team. And those school emergency response people are school psychologists, counselors, and those type of professionals that are already working within the schools. They use them as a force multiplier when an incident occurs within their service cooperative area. Each school, especially when you get to the greater Minnesota area, does not have the amount of resources necessary to respond to some of these major crises that do impact the schools. And by using each other and coming cooperatively together as a team, it becomes quite the force multiplier. The key is to be able to identify those resources prior to an incident occurring. And that's what I believe this House File 1712 addresses, is in that identification of resources prior to an event that occurs within the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate your testimony. Are there other people in the audience who wish to testify on House File 1712? All right, not seeing anybody. Any questions from committee members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Johnson, can you identify for us regions where there aren't these types of teams organized?
Mr. Johnson.
There are 9 service cooperatives, educational cooperatives throughout the state of Minnesota. The Southwest West Central is the only one that I'm aware of that has a formal team that's been identified. However, all of the other service cooperatives in which we partner with a lot of our trainings over this past year, they do have more informal teams that they would have informal agreements between the different school districts, local public health, behavioral health specialists that would come together. What's unique about the Southwest and West Central Cooperative is they formalized their process in identifying prior to events who would be available and who would be the team leaders that would be called on to bring those resources to the situation.
Thank you. All right. Any further questions? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly for Representative Quam, I think this is a good bill. I do note that, of course, our public safety account in the legislature currently meets the budgetary needs of the center. Is it this bill's expectation then that the costs that will be, or perhaps let me ask it this way, do you anticipate costs to the Department of Education to carry out this work? And if so, would it be the responsibility of this committee then to cover those costs for the department's work?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mariani. Frankly, I don't think it's firmed up enough to understand where the costs may lie Conceptually, I thought you may end up having similar to stipends for coaches. You know, a stipend for members of this team. And since it would be regional, you know, I'm not sure where that would come from. There are training costs, and is that through a regional co-op, or it might be a different form? So, you know, frankly, I wish that we were far enough along to where we'd be able to say, here's the dollars, here's the different accounts, and come to. I think we're at the planning stage of where we're not there yet, but I do know that we want to have the Department of Education and the commissioner involved in helping to bring this forth.
And I think maybe representative from the department would like to comment, so I'm going to invite Mr. Uni down.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, my name is Adosh Uni, Department of Education. We have looked at the bill and seen that it's got a lot of merit. There are some gaps around the state. We do think that the department should be involved in coordination with the Department of Public Safety. We see that as value there, but there will be some costs. We haven't looked at exactly what it would be. I'm not personally sure if a fiscal note has been requested, but we don't have the specific staff who have the expertise to do the identification now. We do have the kind of the institutional capacity to build up that staff and support them, but there would be some costs, and I'm not sure what exactly it would be.
Thank you, Mr. Uni, and thank you for the question, Representative Mariani. And I don't think we had requested a fiscal note, but I'm going to request one, and then maybe that will help us put some specific figures to that, because I do think your proposal has merit, Representative Kwan, but we'll need to quantify, obviously, the cost, because that's what we do here. So, any other questions? All right, with that, closing comment, Representative Kwan.
Madam Chair, members, frankly, you know, that might seem like a small thing, but in a community, it's a big thing. And thank you for the time and consideration on moving forward with something along this line. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that, Representative Kwan renews his motion. The House Bill 1712 be referred to Ways and Means. The chair's intention of laying it over today for possible inclusion. And with that, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brooklyn Center has a community school that is having success. Duluth has got a community schools that are having success. When you think about community schools as being the heart of the community or the city or any school in a neighborhood, it seems to draw all the people for some purposes. They're open, they're vibrant, they're enthusiastic, and they're able to close the achievement gaps to solve problems other than the basic learning problems. Full service community schools could be open 24 hours a day. Probably not, but much more than 7:30 to 4:30. The heart has to beat all the time. Community has to work together. The county, the city, the police, the HRA, as we've learned today. Everything has to be together. And it can be and should be done through schools. And we have here today examples of successes that can tell you how they are using the community schools. We have people from Brooklyn Center and people from Duluth. And I would like to start and introduce Kathy Bogan, Jay Newcomb from Duluth, but I'm asking them to speak second because Brooklyn Center didn't get a chance in Representative Erickson's committee, and so we want to start with, is it Patrice Howard from Brooklyn Center?
You're well, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Patrice Howard. I represent Brooklyn Center Community Schools as the Director of Community Schools and Partnerships. I ask that you direct your attention to page 2 of that beautiful, colorful document you have there, green and purple and yellow. Brooklyn Center Community Schools is the first full-service community school district in the state of Minnesota with over 100 partnerships, many of which are co-located services. For example, we have an on-site community clinic that provides free medical, dental, mental health, vision services, and social support services for over 300 young people annually. We began this work many years ago, but began the implementation of the national model in 2009 when former Superintendent Keith Lester took a gamble after seeking strategies to improve educational outcomes for young people. We quickly achieved outstanding results, and by 2010 hired a full-time district administrator as coordinator, that'd be me. This legislation presented is my work and also aligns with Minnesota's world's best workforce goals. One of those goals is to have all kids graduate high school. In Brooklyn Center, about 87% of our seniors graduated last year, up from 74% in 2010. At Brooklyn Center Community Schools, we work relentlessly to provide integrated services that complement the 8 components addressed by the Coalition of Community Schools that support the whole child. My work includes the coordination of partnerships, facilitation of action teams, grant writing, evaluation and reports, identifying needs through asset mapping and needs-based assessments, and negotiating service agreements and MOUs. In addition, I oversee 3 departments, family and community engagement, out-of-school time programming, and health and wellness. I believe in this work. I've seen its fruit nationally and firsthand here at Brooklyn Center Schools. Rather, that's through 3,000 individuals accessing free on-site health services, 200 of which access mental health services, 700-plus youth accessing 21st-century programs at our middle and high school, with another 400 or so accessing similar opportunities at our elementary schools delivered through our partners at no cost to the district or families. Or are families becoming successful through self-sufficiency by accessing and utilizing services in addition to family nights and parent education programming, or through increased student attendance rates and graduation rates? As a full-service community school district, we believe in eliminating and reducing barriers through uniting communities and staying true to the notion that school is the hub of the community, and believing in the work of national founder Joy Dreyfus that a true community school model provides services all day, every day. Again, we are committed to this work. We know that it works, as evidenced by our increased levels of family and community engagement and graduation rates, to name a few. We know that if this strategy is sustained and supported, Brooklyn Center Community Schools will continue to strive, as well as other districts in our state, for the sake of our young people. Thank you, Representative Murphy, for bringing this bill forward, and Representative Loon and committee members. I would like to extend an invite to you to also come and visit Brooklyn Center Community Schools at any time. Thank you.
Thank you. And some of you might be wondering, why is Mary Murphy carrying a bill that has to do with Brooklyn Center? Well, for 35 years, I've lived in Brooklyn Center while I've been a state representative. And so our kids, the kids in the family that I stayed with, we're graduates of Brooklyn Center.
Council.
Not know that.
Mr. Newcomb and Ms. Bogan is here from the Ruth Wilkins, or Ruth Myers Marge Wilkins School in Duluth.
Okay. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about the community schools model. I'm Kathy Bogan, a founding member of the Myers-Wilkins Community School Collaborative in Duluth, Minnesota.
And I'm Jay Newcomb, also a founding member and currently a board member of the Myers-Wilkins Community School Collaborative. We're here to describe for you how this nationally established community school model is improving academic achievement, health, and youth development at our neighborhood school and in schools across the country.
This discussion is particularly germane to some that preceded about homelessness, numbers of students in homeless, and the kind of complexity of issues that face those students and their families. Myers-Wilkins is home to 10 to 15% of our students being homeless, and additionally, many students who have a variety of circumstances that impact their learning. And we found this community schools model to be a really effective way of addressing some of those needs. House File Bill 1709 and its companion bill, Senate File 1206, provide funding for establishing community school coordinators in approximately 40 school sites throughout our state. The reason for creating and supporting these positions is that while communities often have a multitude of organizations and agencies that are available to meet the multifarious needs of our young people and their families, ensuring access requires coordination at the school sites, along with transportation, food, enrollment services, governance, and community engagement.
The community school model addresses both academic rigor and multiple factors that influence young people's learning. This is done in an intentional and well-aligned manner, resulting in a high level of family engagement and coordination of educational and supportive services. Based on research and the promising practices of the Coalition for Community Schools, Myers-Wilkins now offers an extensive array of after-school and summer enrichment, academic intervention programs, family, cultural, and learning events, on-site dental care, and mental health services. Out-of-school time programs serve 400 children a year at a cost of only $650 a student. This includes instruction, snacks, transportation home. In 2014, we had over 120 work-study students and volunteers providing over 3,900 hours of service.
The results of our work together are making a positive difference in young people's lives, especially those experiencing the greatest barriers to academic achievement. Here are some examples. Although Myers-Wilkins is the highest poverty and most racially diverse school in Duluth, it has never been cited by the state of Minnesota for low achievement or failure to meet achievement gap reduction goals. Additionally, those students who attend the six-week summer school programs at Myers-Wilkins do not experience summer slide, which is a three-month or more regression in learning common in children living in poverty. 80% of our students in our after-school programs were able to meet their literacy and math goals, which are set in collaboration with their classroom teachers and tracked using continuous learning plans. We can attribute these positive results to the dedication of Myers-Wilkins teachers and its community partners, which provide support and exemplary out-of-school time programs, which focus on academics, socio-emotional skills, and enrichment.
Partnerships allow us to provide a variety of services to meet the needs of underserved children and families, but they require a lot of communication and coordination to create a cohesive system structure for accessible services. The community school coordinator provides training for all staff, volunteers, and organizations providing services. They provide logistics of space, transportation, food, and child care. They also play a key role in leveraging additional funds to provide this support.
In the interest of closing gaps in achievement and graduation rates, we would like to see the community school model implemented at other schools in our city and throughout the state's urban, small city, and rural communities. While our organization is a 501c3 nonprofit, this is not a practical way to scale up to the level that we need to and to be sustainable. In our community, for example, Mayors Wilkins families have cited a great need for extending the community school model to the middle and high school levels, thus providing ongoing support and engagement for their children through to graduation. Legislation to establish guidelines and funding dedicated to supporting community school coordinator positions in schools is needed. Our young people and communities look to you to provide leadership that will effectively close the achievement and opportunity gap that exists in Minnesota. Supporting House File 1709, which will provide funding for community school coordinators in our high-poverty schools, is a cost-effective strategy that will empower communities to do this. Thanks, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for bringing forward this bill.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I know Representative Mullery has a question. I'm going to first see if there's anyone else who wants to testify from the audience, and then we'll reserve the rest of our time for questions. Welcome.
Thank you. Very quickly, Madam Chair, I'm Louise Sundin, and I'm here representing the Minneapolis educators, teachers, and educational support professionals. And I want to start by thanking Representative Murphy for carrying this bill. It is the number one desire of the teachers and educational support professionals that the importance of this bill is a number one in their hearts and their desires. And it's because I've been around the block of a little that I want to just say why it's so important. And it was just referred to by you that the infrastructure part of this bill is what is going to make it, as you said, sustainable. And the infrastructure we didn't have back a couple of decades ago when we had wraparound services, full service support schools. So what happened to them? We didn't have the site coordinator, and the such as Ms. Patrice was, and you heard her rattle off all of the things that she does as a part of her job, and those are so critical to keeping it, getting it up and running, keeping it going, keeping it sustaining the partnerships. It requires a plan, requires a leadership team at the site, and it requires the review and the regular reports. Those are all critical to sustaining it and scaling up. So we have come a long way. This is 2.0, and with those support systems, I think we'd be able to get to another, hopefully, a decade or so. But there's a second thing besides the practical supports. Second thing is political, and the political supports need to be there also, because what happens, and the reason that we're in 2.0 and not still in 1.0 is because politics happens. And then commitments that are made by mayors and superintendents and commitments that are made by health professionals and in like Alina is one of ours, and budget priorities change and finances happen, like the Great Recession, and all of those things impact on what happens to those commitments that those bureaucracies have made. And your point, Representative, was exactly correct. You can't change and get those commitments in major bureaucracies, both public and private sector, without somebody looking after it and continually nurturing and challenging and seeing that those are healthy partnerships. So my point is that we need also, in addition to all of the political supports that are outlined in Representative Murphy's bill, I would ask you and invite you to also be champions of these schools. They will need political champions also so that we can maintain, sustain, and scale up this wonderful model. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? right, seeing none, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions I've been trying to figure out as I'm reading through this, Representative Murphy, whether or not anywhere in here it kind of directs where this is going to go, or sometimes you're very good at writing language in bills that either excludes or directs and keeps us from figuring it out quickly. So I'm just kind of wondering that. Would every school district in the state or would this be available to them is my first question. And then the second, by the way, Representative Murphy, I knew you lived there, but also the Brooklyn Center School District at one time had about half of their students were from my district, so I'm very familiar with it. But what about, it says must receive $100,000 annually, and I know I've been at a couple planning meetings for a community school in Minneapolis. Would, if they, I don't know how much might go into this, but would it be possible that if the to have less than that go into a site and still get the needed money? I'm just kind of wondering if a site could get going and without that much, would that be possible under this to get something?
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, this is a work in progress. This, my hope is that you are as kind as Representative Erickson's committee was to include it in the possibility in the bill. And as we go along and form the bill, we can bring in specifics that you address. And they certainly don't have to be exactly a 1709. But as I hear about the bill and about the sites, now, Ms. Bogan said that the 501c's or whatever isn't quite the perfect thing. The wraparounds that Ms. Sundin referred to, we know they work to a point, and every school district has a little bit of the wraparound in it. As we're going along. But the one thing I hear, and Ms. Howard made it very clear, that you need a site coordinator. And Ms. Bogan, from being a teacher at the Myers-Wilkins School before under a different name, the Grant School, I think it was, Ulysses Grant, but she came out of the Grant School and became the site coordinator for the Myers-Wilkins School. And she knows, Ms. Howard knows, that the coordinator is probably the most intense person. And she's that coordinator, he or she, has to make the thing go and is the main vein to the ventricle, or whatever it is, to the heart that I was talking about. There, that's essential. And whatever we decide, the amount has to be for the coordinator. And I think we were talking about, in the bill is talking about $100,000. That isn't just for the coordinator, that's for the transportation things and a little bit of this and a little bit of that and so forth, the costs that are connected to the coordinator's office. And so I can't imagine that a whole site could go along on much less than $100,000. But as Ms. Sundin said, Mr. Newcomb said, yeah, we can't do it all at once. We have to set up some steps along the way. And so we have to talk more. But it has, in order to talk more, it has to be included. And you heard me last week. I know that our target is bound for a statewide full-service schools, but there could be some. There could be some expansions of where they are. There could be some offers, some pilots or some offers as we go through.
Follow up, Representative Mullery.
I think I got an answer out of that.
You did.
One of the two questions.
I heard it. Yes. Other questions? Yes, Ms. Bogan.
Well, I thought I could just expand a little on that. The process of how sites would be selected, some of this has been discussed. When we look at the scaling up of the community schools model, looking just nationally, we probably would be looking at those. We would be looking at a process for identifying schools that were ready and had the need. When I look at whether a school ready, there does need to be, as Representative Murphy mentioned, a political will within that school district. That site coordinator works hand in hand with the superintendent and the principal of the school, and therefore we need to see that schools are ready to move in this direction. And we know from the Minnesota Network of Community Schools that is kind of in its infancy, that we do have schools in our state who are setting the groundwork for doing this.
And Madam Chair,
Ms. Howard,
Representative, if I can just add to that, this is the coordinator position is a highly skilled position. Mm-hmm. I am actually a district cabinet member. Mm-hmm. It was done so that way so that I can have the ear of the superintendent so that I can make some of those decisions on his behalf without him being there necessarily. This person has a great deal of experience, such as a school principal, so as far as education is concerned.
And Madam Chair, just
Ms. Sundin,
one personal comment too is that I am struck listening to all of the bills today and other days about how beautifully they all fit together to build a comprehensive support system for the families in Minnesota, including all of their students and all of their needs. And so you're lucky to have such a good job to be able to put them all together into this wonderful whole. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I was going to say thank you. I'll take all the positive comments I can get. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quickly, my concern, and maybe Representative Murphy is looking that way as it progresses, but I know that some of the teachers are telling me they're so excited about this, they're willing to dedicate time of their own to getting it going, and some of the school district is, and I'm just wondering, when you say it has to be at least 100,000, if the school district is willing to match part of that, why would we not jump at that chance and say, okay, we can make this site go if we give them 50,000 or something like that? And it just seems...
We'll take offers.
She sounds flexible, Representative Mallory.
Partnerships, working together with established people and new, or established partners and new partners.
I had a question for both the a representative from Myers-Wilkins and then also from Brooklyn Center. And I know Myers-Wilkins, you mentioned this, that there was a nonprofit that came in and sort of helped get this off the ground. Was that also the case in Brooklyn Center? And is there still nonprofit involvement or financial support in your community school efforts?
Madam Chair, our strategy works a little bit different than Duluth. There is no one set way to do so. A lot of school districts across the nation do rely on the support of a community-based organization or nonprofit. We, however, do not have one. It just so happened, like I mentioned in my testimony, that former Superintendent Keith Lesser just took a gamble, and he just said, you know what, we're going to do so and see if it works. And since then, the district and the board has been supportive of it. And we do have a number of partners where they contribute to whatever specific service that is, meaning that they contribute financially to that service. So, but it's just me, school district employee, that's pretty much coordinating the efforts.
Thank you. And Ms. Bogan, anything to add to that?
I think essentially when people ask about, well, this community school model, this position that we are looking to fund, the coordinator, is really the glue for many of our partners are also nonprofits. So the nonprofit sector has a very big role to play here. But as we were discussing, you know, political will and change and sustainability and stability of this position, that position in itself is what enables all of these partners to work together, including governmental partners such as the county. We have a partnership with public health, the city. And so when we looked at, we were asked a little bit about what would it take to scale this model up. And so I really did look at, okay, our nonprofit is 16 years old, so we started very grassroots. But really in communities where this has taken off, it has taken that infusion of a sustainable financial support that will, at the very minimum, keep this office of the coordinator viable.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. With that, Representative Murphy, I don't think we formally moved your bill, so I think we better do that.
And Madam Chair, I move that House File 1709 be held over for possible inclusion in the finance bill, education finance bill.
Very good. And with that, I thank you all for your testimony today. Thank you for traveling from Duluth and being with us and sharing your examples. So there, it's a great success stories that you shared with us, and I appreciate that. So, thank you. With that, I think we are adjourned for the day. We'll see you all tomorrow. Thank you.